Good morning. You're listening to KYRS Thin Air Community Radio on what is debatably, I guess it's my first show during the 10th year of KYRS's existence. I found out the actual date is the 26th, so this Saturday was this station's 10th birthday. So happy birthday, KYRS. I'm at about my 1.5th birthday at the station here doing the show. And today I've got a great, hopefully a great show, great interview lined up about some of the, this October has been kind of marked by police drama, even more so than usual in Spokane. So I have on hold right now Liz Moore, the director at the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, working with the Spark Police Accountability Reform Coalition and many other groups. So I'm going to bring her on right now to talk about more of this. Can you hear me, Liz?
I can hear you.
All right, you're on the air.
All right.
How is your morning going so far?
It's going pretty good. How's yours?
Good. I just got in here and ready to go. So, So I've been reading the past Tim Connor's really good articles about this drama happening with police accountability through the month of October. And Proposition One, can you summarize that story for folks? I think you could probably do it more effectively than me.
I'll try. Yeah, it's a long saga actually that's gotten us to this moment in time. So I will try to summarize. This community, leaders in this community have been calling for accountability around police since the mid-70s. Carl Maxey said in 1975 that there has to be a way to have a determination of what happened when there's a death caused by a police officer, for example. And so 38 years later, that's still what we're working toward. I've been involved for 4 years myself. Other people have been involved quite a bit longer. In January or February of this year, there was a special election to change the city charter to say, by a vote of the people, we say that in Spokane, we have the standard of independent oversight of police that includes independent investigations, public reports on those investigations, and a commission that guides and oversees the work of this independent ombudsman. And that passed with a 70% yes vote, which is a historic level. Anytime anything passes at a 70% level, that's a moment of history. And to date, that mandate is still not implemented. We had been in negotiations, the city had been in negotiations with the police guild for 22 months, from January 2012 until October 2013. And miraculously, the 2 days before there was going to be a vote at city council to put an ordinance in place to implement that charter guarantee of independent oversight, magically, the city and the police guild were able to come to the resolution of that 22 months of disagreement and use that new, though still secret, tentative agreement about their new contract to put up a blockade in front of that ordinance and convince city council members it would be a bad idea to implement the ordinance at that time. So right now at this moment, we are waiting for that secret tentative agreement between the city and the police guild, police union, to go public. It will happen sometime this week. The guild voted on that ordinance, on that agreement about their contract last week, which means it's no longer part of the secret process. Now it can be public, but people can look at it after the guild looked at it. And there will be some number of hearings coming up. Council members have promised that there will be independent oversight implement, or an ordinance passed to implement independent oversight by the end of the year, when that new tentative agreement with the guild would also be ratified by the city. So it's a long and convoluted story. The through line, though, is that we still don't have what people were calling for 38 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the police continue to interact with the public on a daily basis, and the public has nowhere to go to have an independent investigation because the ombudsman, although he has the title, that if you look in the dictionary, will tell you that it is a position that is created to independently investigate an institution. He does not have the power to do anything more than observe and monitor the Internal Affairs Department of the Police Department, which consistently, overwhelmingly clears officers when complaints are made by the public.
So what I'm not a lawyer, and so Proposition 1 was an amendment to the city charter.
That's right.
Which is the equivalent of Spokane's constitution, right? It's the
city's
main legal document. How could an individual union like the police guild even override that in the first place?
Yeah. Why is it even involved? So the answer actually goes back to 2008 when the Office of Police Ombudsman was created under the Verner administration. And the Verner administration made the decision to negotiate with the police guild about the creation of the Office of Police Ombudsman and constructed the Office of Police Ombudsman in a way that was the result of negotiations with the police. And the agreement about how that position was created was written into the contract with the police guild in 2008. And that set us on this path, that choice set us on this path where the police guild now feels able to strongly argue, and I think the city legal department does not feel able to strongly challenge the idea that once it becomes a topic of bargaining, it has to continue as a topic of bargaining, or there has to be bargaining to keep it out of bargaining in the future. So it was a political choice, I think, that was made in 2008. Maybe with the best of intentions of that being the quickest road to get it done. I don't know. But the result is that, 5 years later, we're still waiting for the members of the police department to agree to be subject to independent oversight.
And so that brings us right to what I'm wondering now and have been wondering. I went to the main Spokane Police Department website, and there's been a huge effort since Frank Straub was brought in as the new chief to sort of rebrand the police department, and they hired a new PR person. They've, made all these statements about how they really want to be, we want to change, and reading over they have an update, a presentation on their use of force policy. And a lot of it sounds great. It's, we're going to do all this new training. We're going to change the culture in these specific ways. And one of those items is we want the ombudsman's office to have independent oversight. So where does this disconnect come between, is it the officers themselves involved with the guild versus the leadership, or is it a message versus action disconnect?
That's really the key question. And one of the problems of not having independent oversight is that the curtains are closed and we can't really see inside. But what we know from this latest round of negotiating, where Mayor Condon's city legal department was negotiating with the police guild, is that the latest round of this, and when the tentative agreement about the contract goes public, this will be part of what goes public as well. There is a chart that shows for police oversight, what did the city ask for? What did Mayor Condon's legal department ask for? And what did the guild say in response? And our allies at the Center for Justice have seen this. It was shared with them by Councilman Salvatore on the condition of not releasing it until the whole thing can go public, but they are allowed to share their analysis of what they saw. And what they saw shows that, in fact, in this latest round, Mayor Condon's legal department did not ever request independent oversight. So at this exact moment in time, the burden, the blockade is not the guild. They can't be held responsible for saying no to something that they were never asked for. So there are changes that Chief Straub can make and I think has made. He has officers training alongside social workers, for example, on how to deal with psychiatric emergencies, to treat them as psychiatric emergencies and not as criminal events, for example. Mm-hmm. there are, I think, some important cultural and structural changes that he's made about how the department is organized. But in this case, he can't move independent oversight because it has to be negotiated with the guild, and that only comes from the mayor's office. And what we know is that the mayor's office did not even work for that in this latest round with the guild.
And what's, I don't know, maybe this is not a question you can answer, but what's the point of not being transparent? I mean, you'd think that even the police would want to have a police department that doesn't, you know, kill people accidentally with alarming frequency. You'd think that that would be a kind of shared goal for everyone. And that's kind of the gist of the comments.
It's a good question. That's a really good question. It is in the interest of police officers to be trusted by the community and to be part of an institution that is trusted by the community. And that's not the case in Spokane. I mean, I've had conversations with, you know, middle-class white women who say they would be really reluctant to call the police if something happened because they wouldn't want the person they're reporting to get shot. But there is a widespread, very low level of trust and very high level of suspicion and distrust with regard to the police, and that doesn't do any good for our community. It is in the interest of members of the community and individual police officers to know that if something bad happens, if something wrong happens, there'll be accountability for the individuals who do that, and that that policy will change or the training will change, that that won't happen again. And I think that, you know, I have never been able to speak with members of the guild directly. I think that what I have heard is that the former president, Ernie Wooldridge, I'm getting his name a little bit wrong, Ernie Wooldridge, who was the former president of the guild, spoke at city council one of the times that reform was up for a vote, and said that members of the guild supported the idea of independent oversight. I think that they believe, and you know, rightly so, according to labor laws, that when there are changes to their working conditions, it has to be bargained and not just implemented by management. The problem is that if it had never been constructed in a way that affects working conditions, it never would have had to go into negotiations in the first place. And that was a problem created back in 2008. So, Chief Straub is publicly in favor of independent oversight, but doesn't have the authority to move toward it. Many would argue that Mayor Condon won and became mayor of Spokane because of the problems with how the Verner administration had dealt with police oversight. And I can't see that it's anything but a failure of leadership, a failure of the ability to get the job done, to come back after 22 months of negotiations without what should be the number one priority when dealing with the police union at this moment in the city of Spokane. It really comes back to squarely rest on the mayor to whom the city attorney and the legal department reports. It all comes back to him not clearly enough saying, get this job done, here's our top priority, accomplish independent oversight, make sure we can implement the city charter guarantee of oversight.
And it shouldn't be, maybe this is naive, but it shouldn't be a hard thing to do.
It's right.
Like, just make a line between the ombudsman's office and the internal investigations. And he has his own filing cabinet instead of a key to theirs. You know, it seems like a very overwhelmingly simple thing to do. But
It is. And I think that it seems that way because you have done your homework for the show, and you've done the research on it. And I have been part of some really helpful meetings with Brian Beggs, who's a local civil rights attorney, and people from the Center for Justice who are really helping to delineate. I'm not an attorney either, helping to delineate the difference between being involved in disciplinary investigations, which are legitimately something that has to be bargained about, versus being able to do independent investigations on the other side of the line, have nothing to do with with discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And blurring, it's like a Venn diagram. If you can picture where those two circles overlap, there's the, on one side, there's the independent oversight that's just about identifying changes for the future, policy changes, what really happened. And then this other circle that is about discipline.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in 2008 is that those two circles were merged and blurry. There was this blurry middle part where the ombudsman can not only just observe and monitor internal affairs, which is actually on the safe side of the line, but actually can assess whether the investigations by internal affairs were completed in a thorough, timely, and objective manner.
Mm-hmm.
That's the blurry part. The problem is he can't say, did they come up with the right conclusion? He can just say, did they interview all the people that should have been interviewed?
Mm.
But he doesn't. It's not substantive enough to accomplish the oversight. It's just blurry enough to allow the Guild to argue that it's a topic of negotiations. Does that make sense?
It does. Well,
it doesn't get done what we as a community need it to get done, but it blurs the line just enough for the Guild to make a strong argument about it being a subject of bargaining, and that's really the crux of the error of how we're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, you know, many different models of oversight. And I think that it's possible that there wasn't enough clear thinking done about what is the end goal of all these negotiations, and maybe, you know, this is no excuse because 70% of the people voted for it, so get it done, like create independent oversight already.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that blurriness might have been a bit confusing, which is, you know, no excuse for not untangling it and getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of the reality.
And do you think, I mean, obviously you have to conjecture because you haven't interacted with members of the Guild, but do you think the wariness from their end is about protecting the institution and maybe what are the cultural practices that are leading to these, you know, systemic problems? Or is it to protect individuals from being singled out in the case of, what's his name? Why am I forgetting his name?
Like Carl Thompson.
Carl Thompson, yeah. Is it,
yeah.
Which of those do you think that it...
Or is it, you know, so Carl Thompson is the officer that arrived at the Zip Trip and beat Otto Zem with his special Ironwood club that he got special permission to use so that he could have a club that lasted longer than regular clubs when they're involved in hitting. So he's one guy, but then there are these six guys. I don't know their names, but I think their names are not secret within the department. There are six guys who kneeled on Otto Zem as he lay there losing consciousness. And I don't know. We have to go by what we know, which is super limited. There's that fact. There's the fact of those somewhere between 30 and 80 officers that stood and saluted Carl Thompson and stood between him and the marshal who was trying to handcuff him.
Mm-hmm.
In court. So there absolutely are, I think it's safe to say there absolutely are significantly widespread cultural problems within the police department about how, that are really, maybe seem to be about how, what level of force do police officers have the right to use and have it not be questioned,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that seems to be a reality, but I tend to think that there are also a lot of police officers who would speak out against practices that violate their own ethics if that was what was expected of them. You know, this last Tuesday, the 22nd, was the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, and coincidentally on that same day here in Spokane, the Smart Justice Campaign and Greater Spokane Progress hosted this wonderful train, you and I were both at,
mm-hmm.
about
to bring that
racial
up.
Equity and the role of government in creating racial equity, and with an evening event particularly focusing on the role of government creating racial equity in the criminal justice system. And one of the things that struck me from that fantastic day is the discussion of how smoking behavior has changed over time. It's an individual behavior, right? So the first attempts at changing that behavior were, let's make people feel bad about smoking. Let's show those TV commercials of people smoking through the hole in their throat.
Mm-hmm.
And as Glenn Harris, the trainer, pointed out, that's totally ineffective. He himself is a smoker. He says that every day he smokes, knowing that it's not good for him, that it, in fact, could kill him. And that information has no impact on his behavior because it's an addiction. It's not just a choice behavior. It's like a pattern behavior. And he contrasted that approach to changing individual behavior to the newer approach, which is about an institutional approach. It's about now, not only can he not smoke in the room while he gives the presentation,
mm-hmm.
he has to be 25 feet from the door. And as he said, when he smokes outside, second graders mock him. So there, that's a much different approach. It's about changing what is acceptable within an institution because it impacts other people. It's not just about this one person's individual behavior. It's about the secondhand smoke, the impact on other people when that behavior is acceptable, and that we have to take an institutionally focused approach to change
mm-hmm.
so that we can offer people the opportunity to change, but also make it so that the Spokane Police Department is an institution where when someone behaves in a way that is, you know, using excessive force or showing racial bias, for example, that behavior is not acceptable within the institution. And so that's a very long answer to your question, but that's one of the reasons that we've had this emphasis on structurally independent oversight over the police department. Our focus has never been get a new police chief, because that's just a person.
Mm-hmm.
That person has policy change power, that's true, but it's just a person, and we'll have another police chief in the future. It's not about, it is about accountability for individual officers like Carl Thompson, but that's not the only thing it's about. It's about changing the cultural practices so that there is not, and the policy and the procedural practices, so that there is not a 5-year cover-up
mm-hmm.
for an exactly. officer like Carl Thompson.
And what
he couldn't possibly have done that on his own.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do it on his own. That's an institutional response.
And what I wrote down from that training with Glenn Harris, who I may, if we have time at the end, I may share a short video of him talking about some of his work in Seattle. But I wrote down a quote that said, does the institution create an environment where a racist individual cop can function? And that's
yeah.
kind of what, and that changed my thinking about it a little bit. Because if you think about it, right now in Spokane, if I were a cop who had some kind of, you know, violent tendency and or was a racist personally, I could drive around in my squad car most of the day, pulling over specifically black men if I wanted to. Is the race identifier for stops being used right now?
It's about to be implemented. I don't think it's in use yet.
Mm-hmm. But that's the example of a change that would make it harder for me to go about my day as a racist
yeah.
cop, you know,
right.
because eventually, if there were also independent oversight, someone might notice, hey,
mm-hmm.
why are 80% of this person's stops targeted at 1% of the population? That
mm-hmm.
doesn't make a lot of sense. Let's look into it. So I liked that he said that there. And
yeah.
if you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, and I'm talking with Liz Moore, director of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane and member of the SPARC Coalition, which is Spokane Police Reform
Accountability
and Reform Coalition. I finally got it, I think. And I wanted to share real quick that I posted, sometimes I like to put a question on the Facebook page for this show, and I said, what is your level of trust with the Spokane Police Department? 1 to 10, 10 being very high, and why? The two responses so far are both, as you stated earlier, middle-class white women, who I know. They both said 3, which is not high. The first said, their shoot-to-kill policy scares me. People are being shot and killed in what seems to be preventable situations. I think they are too ready to shoot and kill and then find out the facts later. Too often the facts are that there were no weapons involved. There seems to be little accountability. All you have to do is listen to the news to know corruption and misbehavior is evident in our police department. A better question might be, why would you trust the police based on their behavior? The second
yeah,
person...
What,
Oh, no,
I'd like
for
to
it.
Know, what would it take right now to build that trust?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and you know, we said that, actually. We said that in February when we voted 70% for independent oversight.
Mm-hmm.
We said this is a precondition. It doesn't mean that's the only thing, but that's a precondition to rebuilding trust. Independent oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead. What's the second person say?
The second person says, I echo the first person's concern about the shoot to kill policy. I also have concerns about their low level of training in dealing with mentally ill people, low level of training in use of force, low level of training in use of tasers, and poor police policy regarding use of tasers, high number of reports of racial profiling, too numerous to ignore, previous low level of accountability within the department, and intense secrecy of police guild in their opposition to police accountability. Sounds like an outline of everything we're talking about today. So,
it does.
So it's not
well-educated listeners.
Yeah, I guess so. And anyone else, if you want to weigh in on that, you can join the conversation. It's at facebook.com/praxisradio.
So there are two things that I would like to comment on, if I can.
Of course.
I don't know if you were about to ask anything. So one thing is that I wanted to comment on the use of force training. One of the things that came out that was maybe the most important thing, or certainly one of the most important things that came out during Carl Thompson's trial, and for anyone that, you know, just moved to Spokane in the last month, remember Carl Thompson, again, was the officer who, in 2007, clubbed and tasered Otto Zem, who then died after committing zero crime at all. And he was charged with federal charges of violations of civil rights through excessive use of force and lying to investigators to cover up that excessive use of force. And in his trial, the officer who trains police for the Spokane Police Department testified that everything Carl Thompson did was by the book as far as training went, and went on to explain what is called this force plus one protocol, which means that officers are trained that whatever level of force you assess is present in the situation when you enter the situation, you yourself use that level of force plus more. It's on the theory that what they tell, you know, what they say is that that's the way to resolve the situation most quickly and get everyone safely out of the situation quickest. That's the testimony. But what we can see resulting from that use of force policy is that the man who was driving toward the Salvation Army several weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
And who was shot many times by police officers, there were 7 seconds that elapsed between when they engaged him and when he was dead. And granted, he's got a vehicle. That can be a dangerous weapon, but there are other options available. There are the tire strips to,
mm-hmm.
you know, make it so he can't drive forward anymore. There is a loudspeaker. There are a variety of other tools that could be used in that situation besides bullets and guns.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I wanted to share is that the one of the agreements that was part of the settlement between Otto Zem's mom and them and the city of Spokane was that all police officers would go through 40-hour crisis intervention training on how to deal with people who are mentally ill and or people who are experiencing a psychiatric emergency. And it's part of this really nationally known program called the Memphis Model. It's actually featured on Democracy Now, I think on October 22nd, on the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality. And this is the model that had been partially implemented in Spokane previously. Interestingly, one of the tenets of this model is that it should be only officers who volunteer to go through the training, that take part in the training, because those are the folks who are going to have the willingness to learn and the aptitude to apply the new skills that they get out of the training. But the Zem settlement went further to say, no, every patrol officer has to be trained in this new model.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets a stage around what the expectations are. Once you've completed a training at your workplace, you are then expected to be able to use the skills. Whether or not you are willing to learn them, is not relevant to the expectations that are put on you after that training. And that's a really important change that that AutoZim's family made happen in our community. So right now, they are part of the way through the training. The latest that I know is that all the officers will have completed that training by the end of March, according to the lead trainer. And that's really good. Again, the curtains are so closed, it's hard to tell what changes that's making inside the system, but I do have anecdotal evidence to share. And this is that on October 14th, which was 2 weeks ago today, a woman here in town who is a massage therapist and a doula, driving with her children across the Monroe Street Bridge, she saw, and she's given me permission to share this story, she saw a woman sitting on the edge of the Monroe Street Bridge with one leg over. And she said she felt like a force turned her head and made her see this woman. She stopped the car in the middle of traffic. She told her kids to stay in the car. She got out. She waved down traffic. She pointed to the car like she said it was like CPR training. She pointed to the car behind her and said, "You, call 911, pointed to the woman on the ledge. He understood. He was helping block traffic so that her car was safer. And she ran across, jumped across the barricade, and embraced this woman with all the strength that she had in her to keep her from going over the side, and started talking to her and telling her, "I'm not going to leave you. Whatever is happening with you, I will, like, let's go to Denny's and I'll buy you lunch and we'll just talk. And you won't, you're not alone. I'm right here with you. You know, you are loved in this moment." And the woman first tried to go over the edge toward the river. The massage therapist said she used to live in Peaceful Valley, and she knew from experience, she told the woman, "If you go over the edge, you really might not die. You'll just get horribly, horribly injured. You know, we see people go over. Don't go that way. Stay here with me. I'm with you." The woman just stayed rather stoic until she said, "My kids are in the car. I don't want them to see you die." And that kind of cracked this woman, who then began crying. And she said to her, "Why are you doing this? You know, why are you trying to end your life?" And she said, I'm so cold. I'm so tired." And the woman held her face and stroked her face. And then a police officer grabbed the woman who had been about to go over, pulled her off of the edge of the bridge, threw her on the ground so hard that her face was injured, and handcuffed her. And the massage therapist knelt down and said, "I'm with you. I'm not leaving you. You're going to be all right." And then said something to the police officer about, "Why would you do that?" The police officer said into his walkie-talkie, "We got a 78 here." And two other officers came along and separated, using their hands, separated the woman from the woman who was on the ground, pulled her away, and basically bullied her into departing from the situation. So that happened 2 weeks ago. In the midst of, you know, this training that's supposed to be happening with every officer.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. That's a powerful story. And it just it begs the question, how many stories like that did people see and not know to call you and talk to you about it?
No, she didn't call me. I saw her post on Facebook. It was a total coincidence. She had no connection. She had heard of we have a friend in common on Facebook. That's how I found out about this. And she had thought about going to the ombudsman, but wasn't sure what would happen, wasn't sure what kind of investigation would occur, wasn't sure if it would be safe for her to speak out.
Wow.
And hadn't yet when I spoke with her. She's now is planning to do that.
And that speaks volumes about the culture that we have in this community, that this woman wasn't sure if she'd be safe just doing a report, not even calling the police herself and having a direct confrontation, but making an indirect report through the official office about a confrontation.
Yeah, she just wasn't sure what the results would be of that. Because the interaction, you know, she she says, you know, okay, it was good that they got her off the ledge, but she's the one that kept her from going over the ledge. Like, she should have been understood as someone who was doing a good thing, not someone who was interfering with a police operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of attitude to community members is a huge problem. Part of the Memphis model is that you're supposed to make an effort to send a trained officer to the call when it's a psychiatric emergency. I'd like to know whether there was an attempt to send a trained officer to that call. Was that a trained officer who did that?
I certainly hope not.
I don't believe that's what the training says to do.
Mm-hmm.
Are there consequences for violating that policy? If that wasn't a trained officer, are there consequences for treating someone in a psychiatric emergency in that manner? You know, there are a whole bunch of questions, but as I was saying this to a woman from the League of Women Voters, she said, never mind all the policy questions, doesn't a human response involve compassion? Mm-hmm. Doesn't your own human instinct tell you not to treat somebody like that? There shouldn't have to be training to, you know, treat people with dignity when they're in psychiatric crises. And if the training that has been done means that now there has to be unlearning, you know, that's a problem that was created.
Mm-hmm.
Not a natural occurring problem.
Well, and that's something we see with soldiers. That's in mm-hmm. by many considered to be the root of PTSD, is that you have to become, in order to be a soldier, you have to be unsocialized. You have to be divorced from your humanity at some level in order to do the things that job is going to require of you. And then there's not a really good process for, you know, unlearning your unlearning.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
with policing, I think it's been the same, especially since I wasn't there. But I think I get the feeling that the war on drugs, in quotes, is kind of the beginning of this more aggressive, preemptive policing strategy. It's more, you know, there's more like hand-me-down military equipment that police departments have. They have, you know, I mean, the Spokane Police Department has AR-15s and a new shooting range to practice them with. And it's, you know, when do you expect to need to use an AR-15 would be my question to the Spokane Police Department. So it's going back. And that's something else Glenn Harris talked about in that workshop. He talked about, I believe it was the Rainier Beach neighborhood of Seattle, which had a lot of crime problems, a lot of like gang related activity, something like 5 shootings in a month. And they came in and reworked the policing practices so that it was more about going back to the neighborhood beat cop, you know, who walks around on foot,
mm-hmm.
talks to people, gets to know people. And after something like, I don't remember his exact story, but after something like 6 months of that practice, a captain in the police who had gone from, who was one of the most hated individual cops in the street, mm-hmm. had gotten to know people, and was actually, when some group wanted to target him personally, one of the gangs came and surrounded his house and said, we're not going to let you, you know, take this person out. So he went from being, you know, an extremely hated cop to someone who people trusted enough to protect.
Yeah, that was a really stunning story. I think that officer was actually it was, as I recall it, Glenn was illustrating the power of the potential for, in Seattle, for the beat cop model to have impact on the community police relations. But that actual story was from L.A.
Oh, you're right.
Where it was there was the officer who was targeting other officers for basically assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of his name, but he was the one targeting that captain.
Mm-hmm.
And gang members went to his home to protect him from another police officer. It's pretty stunning what can happen when people can actually relate to each other,
mm-hmm.
and can meet each other and interact like human beings. It's really... It can be really transformative.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's where I mixed it up. I remember something that stuck out, because I tend to be an advocate of communities without police forces. and completely community-based policing. And there's problems with that. But in my ideal imaginary society, that's what it would look like.
Yeah.
A good compromise, you know, which talked about with a lot of people, is just they're like professional helpers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The police are just someone who you need help with anything. Call this person whose job it is to help. and that's what Glenn said. They had reframed the neighborhood beat thing in Seattle, and the officers loved it. They loved the feeling of, you know, being able to walk around a neighborhood and just go to people and say, "How can I help you?" So I think there's a lot of potential.
I do too. I think that I would like to, you know, see a survey of Spokane police officers about what moved them to go into that line of work. And I would imagine that, you know, a pretty significant percentage would be saying because they care about their community and they want people to be safe in their community. The reality is that our policies right now are not making people safer. When some people are getting shot or are treated like criminals when they're having a psychiatric crisis, and other people are so distrustful of that same institution that they aren't calling when they need to. It's really, we're not building a safe community with these current policies. It's not working. We're not getting to the end. And, you know, everybody deserves to be safe in the community, and everybody deserves to be treated fairly and without prejudice in the community. And when I think about all of the stories that I've heard about, from African-American men in particular, about being pulled over on a pretext, or an African-American woman told me about a story about seeing an officer make a U-turn in order to come and pull her over, claiming that she had a busted taillight, which he couldn't possibly have seen from being in oncoming traffic. Yet he made a U-turn to come and pull her over. You know, the flimsiness of the pretext in some of these cases is pretty stunning. Or, you know, Dave Edwards' story, which he shared, is being pulled over on his way home from the Martin Luther King parade while he had driven a couple times past a vehicle that he was thinking about buying that was parked in somebody's driveway or yard. He was pulled over on the pretext of not having used his turn signal to make a left turn, which he swears he did. But even if he didn't, what happened next was so terrifying to him that when he went to get his registration out of his license, out of his glove compartment, his sunglasses fell out, and he thought he was going to be shot because sunglasses fell out of his glove compartment. People should not live in that kind of fear. That's not creating a safer community to terrorize Dave Edwards. Let's say he didn't use the turn signal when he turned. You know, that doesn't create a safer community to terrorize somebody whose sunglasses fell out of their compartment. And, you know, it's a part of the problem, I think, is that job is constructed in a way that puts officers in situations where an adrenaline response is a logical human response a lot of times. And then our brains start to develop this situation, this belief that every situation is dangerous, we just don't know it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And some amount of caution makes sense, but having more human interaction, I think, would... And more human interaction that's not, you know, based on a sort of a "I'm going to get you" model, but "I'm going to help you" model.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think that that would make an impact in how every situation is dealt with. You know, one of the changes that is happening under Chief Straub is that officers are going through a class that is, as I understand it, supposed to teach them additional tools to de-escalate a situation without using force. But guess what it's called? You know this? It's called verbal judo. Like, even the way we talk when
exactly
we're police officers.
It's not exactly a non-violence model.
Yeah. We even subdue people with our voices. We don't just, like, we don't de-escalate. We use verbal judo. That's not...
Wow.
I don't feel comfortable with that. That's not what we need to be doing. We don't need to be using verbal judo. We can just, like, maybe use our words. We can do a class called Using Our Words.
Yeah. And that harkens back. I just finished reading. This is only tangentially related, but the verbal judo thing actually may come directly from this tradition. I just read John Ronson's book, The Men Who Stare at Goats. And they made a movie of it, which I haven't seen. But it's a true, it's the true story of the CIA's exploration of using psychic warfare during the end of the Cold War that it turns out had ripple effects into creating the quote-unquote tactics that were used at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo. And it was really interesting how this vision of this kind of hippie, like, we're going to, you know, we're going to use peace to bring peace. You know, we're going to use these really kind of new agey hippie methods, how that was distorted through a culture that was still structurally violent. And how you can have these good ideas, you can have the best of intentions, but if the institutions aren't ready to support an actual change, those can actually just feed into driving the bad practices that already exist.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. It's not a change around the edges that we need. We actually need to reform how we think about how we create safe communities. And it's not through militarizing the police.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the path. It's just that as a country, we're so addicted to patterns of militarism that we apply it without even thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's just this knee-jerk response. Got a problem? Militarize.
Mm-hmm.
And that thinking itself has to be challenged. We need to, you know, stop thinking in this retributive justice model and think about a restorative justice model. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean for then how we create safety on every block so that everybody is safe and, you know, everyone feels confident that they're going to be treated fairly if they have an interaction with the police.
Mm-hmm. And I think another part of that that I want to go back and address before I forget, the racial part of the equation in Spokane, mm-hmm. which I think white people think that it's not a problem here because we have mm-hmm. relatively little racial diversity. But your anecdotal stories about, you know, Dave Edwards, about, you know, this black woman you talk to, everyone I know who's a person of color in Spokane has that story, mm-hmm. I think, without exception. I haven't talked to everyone about it, but it's not unique. And you mentioned, you know, the knee-jerk response of the police, the adrenaline rush. We also need to, and this is something, again, from Glenn Harris's training, create a culture where seeing a black man behind the wheel of a car isn't something that creates an adrenaline rush in people.
Right.
You know, it's
absolutely
inconsequential. It's just a person in a car.
Absolutely.
Or even if you do have a gut reaction, not responding to it. You know, taking the time to think.
Yeah, catching it. And as Glenn also pointed out, you know, neuroscience tells us that trying to suppress our biases as humans actually makes those biases more strong. So what we need to do, it's like cognitive behavioral therapy. It's like catching your self-talk and hearing it and then challenging it consciously. That's how we deal with bias on an individual level, giving people the tools to force ourselves into slower thinking where we actually hear what it is that our learned biases are saying to us so that we can challenge them.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the new demographic data collection that's being done by the police department. And I'd like to say a couple words about that. But before I do that, I want to say that I have data about who was tased in Spokane by the Spokane Police Department from 2009 through 2012, those 4 years. And there are 106. My baby just came in. There are 106 people who were tased during those 4 years. 72% were white. 16% were African American. That's in our community, about 2% of our neighbors are African American or less. But 16% of those tased were African American, and 9% were Native American. Again, as contrasted with about 1% in the population, 1 to 2% in the population. So where we Ava, where we do have data, it's a pretty stunning disproportionality.
There's a baby in the room, so.
There's a baby who wants to nurse. He's pretty determined that it happened. He's a very assertive dude. Oh, now he's a kitty cat.
That's hardly shocking, given his parentage. But and that's something that, so that's proof. That's why it's important to measure, I think. But I think it's really important that measurement not be the end goal.
Yeah.
Because then you can say, hey, look, there actually is a problem in Spokane. Here's what it looks like. And I really like what part of what Glenn Harris and the Race and Social Justice Initiative in Seattle have been able to do. It's required for city employees in Seattle to take a 3-part course in race. And it's a series of videos called Race, the Power of Illusion. And the first one is about a fact that a third of Americans do not know, which is that race on a biological level is not real. You know, it's not, it's, there's no genetic difference between people of different races. And a third of people in the U.S. think that that's true. And he talked about the reactions of police taking that training and looking around the room and saying, did anyone else know that? And then
asking, why wasn't I taught this before? Mm-hmm. Which I think is the where it comes back to institutions. You know, what are we taught in our institutions or not taught and then left to fill in the gaps about?
Mm-hmm. And that helps.
That was a stunning story to me, too. Mm-hmm. Did anybody else know this? And then why have I been kept in the dark about this?
And that opens the door for people to actually grow rather than just say, you're a racist, you're a bad person forever. Saying, you know, you made bad choices and, you know, there's problems you need to deal with on a personal level, but also in this culture, like it's understandable in some ways that you wouldn't know this, and here's your opportunity to learn.
Right.
So I'm hoping we can implement a lot of that here. I have a few announcements to make in the last few minutes, but is there anything else you want to add, resources for people who want to get involved in this work or learn more about it?
I want to say that the Spokane Police Accountability and Reform Coalition meets on the second Wednesday of every month at 5:30 at the Community Building, 35 West Main. If anyone's interested, they can find that information at peacejustice.org, and then you can click on issues and click on police accountability and get that information. It's also on our calendar at peacejustice.org/calendar. You can sign up for action alerts and let us know what issues you care about at peacejustice.org/signup. So there are lots of ways to plug in that way. You can also call the Pajalas office at 838-7870. And I don't know yet the dates, but there will be a number of hearings where folks can comment on whether they think the about to be public new contract with the police meets community standards or not. And those will be publicized to our Pajalas email list and to the email list of other organizations that are involved in the coalition as well. So plugging in now is a good way to make sure you're informed coming up. And we welcome anybody. New people are very welcome at these second Wednesday 5:30 meetings at 35 West Main.
Awesome. And I'll include that those links in the podcast as well, which should be up later today. Right. And where does this all overlap with the Smart Justice group?
You know, there are a lot of overlapping organizations in the two efforts. The Smart Justice campaign is really focused on, it's actually grown and gotten a lot stronger over time. It began with a very specific focus on nonviolent offenders in the county jail, which makes up a majority of people in the county jail. There are people in the county jail for failure to pay court fines. There's people in the county jail for driving with license suspended that doesn't have anything to do with DUI or anything else. And the jail is also a place where there is disproportionality, where African American and Native American men in particular are dramatically overrepresented relative to the population in the city or the county. One of the places that is a really interesting spot of overlap is that the Smart Justice Program is recommending a policy or a program that comes from Seattle, which also has its roots in the Race and Social Justice Initiative, called LEAD, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. And in Seattle, this was developed because there was a neighborhood downtown where there was seeing just dramatic, disproportionate arrests of people of color. And this program was created to offer an alternative where a law enforcement officer could say to the person, you don't have to come to jail, I'm not going to arrest you, if you come with me to this is the diversion part, away from the jail toward this program where you can get connected to resources that can help you make different choices, whether it's drug dealing or prostitution, whatever it may be. So the officer has the option, as another tool in a tool belt besides jail, of diversion to a place where people can get connected with services. And I think it has to do with police accountability and reform, because it changes the relationship between police officers and mm-hmm. the community members. And it has to do with smart justice, because if what somebody needs to change their choices is access to services, let's do that. Let's not lock somebody up when mm-hmm. what they need is access to services. It doesn't create justice, and it wastes a lot of money. So it's a great example of overlap between the two.
Awesome. So peacejustice.org and smartjusticespokane.org is the website for smart justice overlapping causes. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, thank you so much for helping explain the layers of all of this police accountability work, as you said, over the last 38 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Long time coming, and what has been consistent all the way through is that everyday people speaking up is what has resulted in the changes that have happened or that will happen. It's about everyday people sharing their stories and making strong statements together about what's acceptable in our community.
Awesome. Well, I hope it works.
Me too.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And if you just joined us at the end there, that was Liz Moore, director at Peace Justice Action League of Spokane, helping with the SPARC Coalition, Spokane Police Accountability Reform Coalition. I finally got it right, I think. A couple more announcements in the last part of the show, unrelated to police accountability, but important this week, are as follows. On November 2nd, there's going to be a panel featuring two former guests on this show called Can We Afford the Death Penalty? The Loss of Compassion is Too Costly. The panelists are Jason Baldwin, wrongfully convicted, one of the so-called West Memphis Three. I was able to interview him last summer on this show. Bishop Kupich from the Spokane Diocese is going to talk about the spiritual moral aspects of the death penalty. Dick Morgan, who's a former superintendent of Washington State. Oh my gosh, I don't know what that acronym is. So many attorneys. Victoria Thorpe is going to be on the panel. She's the other person that I've interviewed on this show. Her sister is wrongfully on death row in California, and she can talk personally about the faults within the system that her family has seen. And it's going to be moderated by Dr. Ellen Macarone, assistant professor of philosophy at GU. It's a free panel, and it's at the Globe Room at Cataldo Hall at Gonzaga. So that's November 2nd at 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow, Tuesday the 29th at 6:30 p.m. in the community building lobby, KYRS is going to be hosting the first of three of our forums. We received a grant from Humanities Washington to talk about the importance of the humanities in the U.S. and what their loss education-wise and culturally has meant for us, and how we can kind of revive the role of the humanities in our lives, how we can ask the big questions and look at history, and how, shockingly, those things might help us as a culture. So that's also free and open to the public. You can check out our website at kyrs.org for more information about that. Lastly, but not leastly, Horrible Fake Adverbs Day. Mutants for Monsanto, a group that we may have heard of, who they're doing a little bit sneaky pro-GMO labeling from the grassroots level. They are doing a video contest. The Mutants for Monsanto are offering cash prizes for the best video submission celebrating the glories of genetically modified organisms, bad food, and biotech industry run amok. Participants will be entered to win up to $500, a free chicken, and a formal certificate of brilliance from the New Cascadia Press this Halloween at the Magic Lantern Theater at 7 p.m., where the top videos will be screened to the public and the winners will be announced. They'll be aggressively disseminating the best videos over the internet in the lead-up to Election Day on November 5th. To qualify, submissions should be between 1 and 5 minutes, placed on YouTube with a link set to MonsantoMutants@gmail.com before 11:59 p.m. on October 30th, this Wednesday, and be as strange and humorous as possible. So, the free screening of all these movies is Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Magic Lantern Theater, and they are accepting last-minute submissions. So if you're a mutant for Monsanto, you can send in your video. I believe that's it. If you are interested in reading more about these shenanigans with the Police Guild and police oversight, Tim Connor, as usual, has written an excellent series kind of simplifying the issue, linking to some of the information that is not confidential at c4justice.org. All of those stories, there's three main ones through the month of October, are featured on the front page. So c4justice.org, or just Google Center for Justice, Tim Connor, and you will find those. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. And we'll see you next week.